Dude, Wisconsin has to import its strippers from Chicago and Iowa. Think about that for a minute, okay?
Sheboygan.
Sheboygan. No, you do not want strippers from Sheboygan, man. Teeth are optional. You know, no, it's just...
Well, you know what they say. You ain't ever had a Hummer till you had a Gummer.
Well, oh, my God. Oh, I got to fucking edit that out. Fucking guy. See, you thought I was the one that would say stupid shit during the podcast back in the day. I got Justin now who trumps me.
Yeah. Well, you left none in a cucumber patch in. You could probably leave that
all
way.
Right, I think it'll be all right.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, we leave everything. Everything gets in at some point. We don't hide anything in this place.
No. And it's not like you're going to embarrass me. I mean, I've been setting you up for this shit for a year and a half.
All right, guys, welcome to episode 10 of the Model Insanity Podcast. I'm your host, Rob Riv. I'm with my co-host, Mr. Justin Ryan.
Hey, hey.
Mr. Steve Santucci.
Hello.
And Mr. Rob Adams.
Yo, yo.
This is a special episode for the Model Insanity Podcast. This is the first time we're actually recording an episode while we have one in the can and that hasn't been released. But this episode is going to be interview heavy with a very good friend of ours. He's a friend of ours. He's a made guy in the hobby. He's a good friend of mine. He's my former boss. He was the host of the Modeling Miscreant Podcast, Mr. Jeff Hearn. Jeff, hey. How you doing?
Fat, dumb, and happy. Living the dream.
In actuality, we don't have him on here because of the old podcast. He's on this podcast because he's the proprietor of Scale Colors and SC3D Cracks and 3D Printed Accessories. So... again, Jeff, how you been, bud?
I'm doing well. Burning the candle at both ends as usual, but we're plugging away.
You also got a new hat on, too. You are planning the 2024 IPMS Nationals as we speak, and I know that that's been taking up a lot of your time.
I am the 2024 IPMS USA National Convention Chairman. That's the official title.
We're going to get into that a little bit as well, so we're going to try to do a few things at first. Again, I just have to say this because I haven't had an opportunity to really talk to you in a long time. We spoke, but tonight's the night. I'm going to break your chops a little bit.
What else is it?
Me and you and even Steve Santucci were on the, if anybody on this is listening right now knows that we were on the Modeling Miscreant Podcast. It was a podcast that Jeff and Mike Sacklin had started, had asked me to come on. They started it out. First, they did a test episode. The person who was in that third chair wasn't really doing it, so they had asked me to come on and do an episode. I guess history from that point on, right, Jeff?
It was magical.
Yeah, well, I mean, history is, you know, determined by the victors, so.
Oh, shit.
some will say it was great. Some others will you know, shake their heads and roll their eyes. But yeah, we had a good time.
We had a great time. And I know that without the Miscreant Podcast, the Insanity Podcast probably wouldn't exist right now, so... I owe a lot to you with that. You also showed me a lot about the recordings and things like that back then, which helped us do this.
I think what we did was something a little different. And I'm friends with all of the other podcasts that are out there. I know all the guys on a first name basis. Some of them I absolutely consider some of my best friends, and others I'll put the truck in reverse to run over them a second time. But I think what we did with the Miscreants was that we kind of just treated it like a bunch of guys sitting around the workbench, you know, building stuff. We tried to keep it exciting. We tried to keep it humorous and on the lighthearted side, as opposed to listening to some podcasts where, you know, you're literally watching paint dry. When you start nodding off listening to a podcast, you got to have a little help. So fortunately, you know, you were an element that came in and just, you're the nitroglycerin of the group. You know, the spontaneity and the quick wit humor really kind of defined the Miscreants. And, you know, I'm not going to lie. We had a great time, and we were kind of like a shooting star, man. We rose up, you know, and did really, really well for a short period of time. And then, like everything else, it just burned me out.
It did. And you did a lot of work with that. And we had a great time.
We did.
And I'll never want to go back and change anything. That was a good time. Listen, it was the midst of COVID.
Yeah.
There was a lot of shit going on in the world.
Yeah, my dad
died.
And
it gave us an opportunity to just talk the hobby, but we also talked about a lot of other things, and we broke chops. And
yeah.
So here, I got to ask you this question. Now, unfortunately, it's really hard to find any episodes of The Miscreants on like podcast stuff because the Buzzsprout account went dormant. Everything goes bye-bye.
Yeah.
This quick, what was your favorite story that was ever told on The Miscreants?
From a pure comedic standpoint, I think the story that you told about the doll in the attic at Halloween, how the batteries were dying and, you know, you'd hear noises coming from the attic during Halloween. And then when you went up, the light went out or some shit like that.
Yeah.
That had to be probably the funniest sustained story that we had. The funniest bit that you ever had was Mrs. Howell in the fur coat. And
yeah.
And for those who didn't know, Rob's got a thing for Mrs. Howell. You know, it involved Mrs. Howell and fornicating with a fur coat in the closet.
Justin.
Yeah. Justin's over there shaking his head going, oh my God. Serious? Dude, you have no idea.
Yeah, you're right. I don't.
I've got so much dirt on this guy that.
The funny thing about that was, is that conversation, I didn't even know he was recording.
Right.
We were sitting in front of the getting ready for the podcast. I was on my phone and someone's like, what are you doing? And I'm looking at a picture. I'm like, wow, Mrs. Howell was really fucking hot. And it went into me talking about Mrs. Howell for like 10 minutes. And then when I heard the podcast, it was only outtakes. It was hysterical. I was dying. And you know what the crazy thing about that was? I picked my daughter up from college that day and I was listening to the podcast in the car and the outtakes came on while she was in the car about me talking about how hot Mrs.
Lovey.
Fun fact, she was probably only about 39 when that show was filmed.
Well, she was in her mid to late 40s or early 50s when that show.
Why did people look so old back then? Because I don't look that old, do I? And I'm in my mid 40s.
Oil of Olay has made a lot of fucking progress since then.
To give her credit, though, and here's a little tidbit you guys probably didn't know, she was dealing with cancer all the while she was filming Gilligan's Island. She was fighting cancer. So a lot of that was makeup and stuff like that.
Thanks for killing the fucking mood, Jeff. We were having a good time here, for Christ's sake.
Jesus
Christ. What do you expect me to do?
He's a modeler. He's fact-based orientated.
We just had a touch base on the old Miscreant podcast, and the seeing Jeff again is bringing back a lot of memories because we did have a lot of fun, and I appreciate everything you did, Jeff.
Yeah, well, it's good to see that the nervous twitch has gone away. I'm glad they got your medications sorted out, and you know, it's good to be here.
No, it's good. All right. Again, this is going to be Jeff Hearn special. There's going to be very little segments in this podcast. We're not going to do new kits in the news. We're also not going to do any social media shout outs this episode. This is just a straight interview. Hopefully it goes for a while. I told Jeff before he came on, this guy can read the fucking insurance policy to like your Liberty Mutual homeowners insurance.
Liberty.
And he won't stop. So we're going to have to try to like time him and give him like, you know, cuts. So,
wow.
And as always, Mr. Steve Santucci will be leading this interview until I think he's not capable of doing it.
Before we get to Steve, can you guys bring me up to speed? Jeff, bring me up to speed to this whole thing with me being the new guy to the group. What is your origin story? Tell me about Jeff. I want to know who Jeff is.
First, the Earth, there was a big bang, and then the Earth cooled and the dinosaurs came, and then they got too fat and died and became oil. No, I'm paraphrasing the Amps Journal.
I thought you were paraphrasing the
was Steve Andriano's column, so you know he probably stole it from Airplane or some shit like that.
No, he did.
Yeah, he did. No question. I was born and raised on an Indian reservation in upstate New York. Bebopped around, ended up in New Jersey as part of New Jersey IPMS, and ran into Steve Andriano and George Ironman and Neil Stokes were three of the guys that I started, you know, running into at shows on a fairly regular basis. And then they told me about Amps. So I started doing Amps stuff back when they were in Havre de Grace, you know, Aberdeen Proving Grounds, and when all the armor and stuff was still there. And I spent 12 years as the director of the New Jersey Aviation Hall of Fame and Museum in Teterboro, just outside of New York. And I stayed with them until 2005, when I moved from New Jersey to Wisconsin to become editor at Fine Scale Modeler magazine. I did that for a couple of years. They ran me into the ground. And one day I just snapped and said, I've had enough. And I walked out. 6 months later, I had Model X magazine, and that ran for a grand total of 4 issues, with the 5th one on its way to the printer. And unfortunate situation, there were some financial issues that thankfully had nothing to do with me. I was editorial, so I mean, even if I wanted to buy a ream of paper for the printer, I had to submit a receipt. So fortunately for me, I wasn't involved in any of the business side of things. Next thing I know, I'm working in a mining company, and I'm building models, and I'm writing columns, and I'm writing articles. And I was involved in a lot of the early internet groups, the Armoramas and the Hyperscales and Model Warships and Steel Navy.
Back when Al Gore first invented the internet?
Back when Al Gore invented the internet, yeah. And it just kind of morphed into something. I started writing books, and I just, I'm a type A personality. And as Rob said, I never shut up. So, that just kind of segued into, me, good, bad, or ugly, kind of building a name for myself in the hobby, and just kind of being prominent and vocal. One thing led to another, and I'm part of IPMS Mad City Modelers, and we had our local show. We used a small room in a large convention center, and after the show was finished, we said, we're probably going to have to look at getting a bigger room, because our local show is growing so much. And they took us on a tour of this big convention center, and every single one of us kind of looked around and said, wow, we could have a nationals here. 6 months later, we're bidding on the nationals. And we got the bid. So all while that was going on, I worked in the mining industry for a while after I left publishing, and I was involved in a bad car accident and suffered another cumulative traumatic brain injury, a TBI. And I tell people this, and I say it jokingly, but it's the truth. If you've ever had a tequila hangover, I have those every single morning when I wake up, and I don't drink.
Without the joy of the tequila.
Without the joy of the tequila.
What happens if you drink the tequila? Does it just make it worse?
No, it just makes me an asshole with a really bad headache. I gave up drinking a long time ago because I'm enough of an asshole when I'm sober, and you add alcohol to the mix and it just makes things really bad. But so I deal with these headaches every day, and it got to the point where I had difficulty stringing 40 hours, for myself just to lead a normal life. How the hell can you give 40 hours a week to an employer when you can't put 40 hours of quality life together for yourself?
Absolutely.
I started a company, a small company called War Pigs. Way back in the day, I had done some scale modeling pigments and some washes, and that went along pretty well, and it kind of went dormant. And then we had a falling out with a certain person over in England who decided to try to sell my intellectual property. Fortunately, he's behind bars now, so I guess that all worked out for the best. So when the time came to kind of resurrect the pigments and the washes and whatnot, I'm a ship modeler by trade. That's what I'm known for. And I was working on a project, and testers had gone out of business. And I said, shit, where am I going to find 5H Haze Gray? And a buddy of mine said, make it. Make your own paint. I thought he was kind of joking. Found out he was serious. So I put the word out, and I said, are any of my modeling friends, in the paint industry? And sure enough, yeah, what do you want? I just retired from PPG. I was a chemist for 30 years for them. This is what I want. So that kind of launched Scale Colors, and then Scale Colors segued into the tracks and 3D printed stuff. What started out as something to just keep me busy and keep me out of trouble, I'm looking at trying to take this to the next level and actually bring people on board to start actually mass producing this stuff instead of being a closet basement cottage industry modeler. So that's the origin story. I've been in Wisconsin since 2004. Spent a year out here by myself while my wife and my daughter were back on the East Coast from the same town. And this is a funny little segue. I literally, on a good day, if I had a good golf swing from my front yard, I could put a golf ball into Tooch's yard for a dozen years, and we never knew each other. Yeah, I remember the first time I was introduced to him. He's like, oh, you lived in New Jersey? Yeah. Where did you live? Rockaway. Really? We're in Rockaway. White Metal Lake. Wait a minute. Are you like reading my former address or something? Are you messing with me? And sure enough, we were literally a block and a half away.
But the property value was so bad in that area. You got the Hearns and the Santucci's living over there. I wonder why it was so bad.
So, Jeff, is the cheese really as good as they say it is over there in Wisconsin?
It is.
All right.
There's a couple of funny stories being a New Yorker moving out here. And everybody asks me why I talk funny. And I just tell them witness protection program. And I don't laugh. I don't crack a straight face. And then all of a sudden, they're kind of looking at me kind of weird. Bubblers, you know, you go to a drinking fountain. You know, soda is pop. Sneakers are tennis shoes. Pizza here sucks, but the cheese is amazing.
All right.
You know, in the summertime, it's an absolutely beautiful place to be. In the wintertime, it sucks.
I live in Canada, so.
Well, yeah. And I'll be honest with you, you and I probably get that same. You hear it from the Wisconsinites all the time, you know. Oh, we get the dry, cold air off the prairie there, eh? You know, and it's like, okay, it's 35 fucking below zero, and it's like 4% humidity. Thank you, no.
Sorry.
So you have a beautiful July.
We do. And July 2024 is going to be freaking spectacular.
I'm really looking forward to going down there, so I don't get
it much.
It's going
to be a good one.
Yeah.
It's going to be a good one. It's going to be a lot of fun. I know we're working our asses off. I got to clarify this, you know, and make this clear. The Nationals team is, right now, I think we're about 13 or 14, maybe 15 people. And they're basically all doing a full-time job in their specific lanes to make this convention happen. And I work with some fantastic people who are extremely dedicated to the mission that we kind of put together and the vision that we had. Because when we came in, we said, look, we want this to be a Roman spectacle. We want Madison to be the best Nationals that IPMS has ever had. And that's not taking away anything from any of the other national conventions, because there have been some really good national conventions. We just want to be the best. We want to be better than everybody else. And we're trying to achieve that. Whether or not we can remains to be seen, but we're going to give it our all.
Strippers. Get strippers there. In the back room, you will be known as the best IPMS Nationals ever.
Dude, Wisconsin has to import its strippers from Chicago and Iowa. Think about that for a minute, okay?
Sheboygan.
Sheboygan Land. No, you do not want strippers from Sheboygan Land, man.
It's true. We're going to have a good time tonight. But I know, I remember when you first started talking about bidding on the Wisconsin show. And that was the beginning of the madness for Jeff Hearn. That's when you started going a little loopy. That's when you started dropping fucking rubbing alcohol on your chicken fingers and still eating them. You're like, ah, fuck it. I'm eating it. I don't care.
I've eaten things that would make a billy goat puke. You know, I'm not too proud. And you were right. I am that type of person that will take as much as I can take. You know, I'll take whatever load I can carry. And it's probably a fault. You know, it's to my own fault, because then eventually and inevitably, you know, shit slips through the cracks. But with Nationals, I've been blessed as I fall back on my team. When I put this thing together, the first three spots that I filled were people that, you know, had a military background. And that was simply because they could understand what I wanted to do in terms of accomplishing the mission. They were very task-driven and mission-oriented. The number one guy, my registrar, my XO, Merrick Rogel, he's a corporate project manager, and he's worked with NASA and NOAA and, you know, everybody. At any given point in time, he is the smartest man in the room. And he keeps everything on track. He's kind of our producer. He's our executive producer. Keeps our schedules, our tasks, and he calls people out. You know, when stuff is due, we have deadlines for specific things that need to be done. Those guys and Mark Miller, my contest coordinator, Bob Clift, my vendor coordinator, those are my two ex-military guys. I tell them what we want to do, and then I turn them loose and let them do it. And so far, knock on wood, it's worked out fantastic. And then there's a complete cast of characters all the way down the line. You know, I got Jeff Barrett doing my tours, and I got my retired history teacher, Steve Gilbert. He's my seminar coordinator. So, you know, who better than to coordinate and schedule all your seminars than a history teacher?
Jeff's a pretty enthusiastic guy. I met him at the Nationals.
He's intense. He knows his stuff. I'll tell you what, man, if you want to have a 6-hour conversation about the markings on the aircraft on December 7th of 1941, yeah, the man, you know, the guy has probably forgotten more stuff than I'll ever learn.
Yeah, I spent about a half an hour with him, and I was just like, wow.
Yeah, he's our seminar coordinator, which is fantastic. I've got some young upstarts, some of the younger members of the club that are going to be running the raffle, because, hey, you know what? You need a young guy with enthusiasm running the raffle, and Jeremy Olson will be running the raffle. And then there's a lot of jobs that are kind of behind the scenes that you know, our computer jobs and our volunteer coordinators, John Kruger, John Liddell. I'm trying to give a shout out to everybody that's involved. And I'm inevitably, I know I'm going to miss somebody. Brett Dillenbeck, our head of security.
Oh, Brett's a great guy.
Brett's an awesome guy. So all of these people have come together. And for the first, I don't know, probably 3 or 4 months, we'd get on these Zoom meetings and we would just think tank. What can we do? What can we do better than anybody else has ever done? What can we do differently? What are the things that we can bring to the table to make this really special? And then we took about 3 or 4 months to put that together after we had won the bid. And we all agreed on what, you know, we wanted to do. And then after that was said and done, we kind of just sent everybody off in their own directions to do, you know, what they had been tasked with doing. It's worked out really well. I've got a phenomenal team. I can't speak highly enough. They've made me, number one, they've made me look competent.
Which is hard to do.
Which is very hard to do. They've sheltered me from a lot of the stupidity. Alan Zeiss, who's my public affairs officer, he's taken the brunt of the stupid questions because there are a lot of stupid questions.
It's like a Fortune 500 company, you, with all these tiers of people.
It really is. It really is. And it has to be. Just the magnitude and the volume of the stuff that comes in once you start running the nationals. Every one of you guys has been involved in putting a model show together, you know, a local right. One-day show. You got about 6 or 8 guys that go crazy for about 3 or 4 weeks putting a show together.
Right.
And imagine a show that's 10 times or 15, 20 times that size that's running over the course of 4 days. And then there's a whole logistical stuff from shuttle buses to tours to feeding people, you know, food and beverage, catering, tax ramifications, you know, for the vendors coming in. You got to have all that stuff together.
Locations of beer.
Exactly. And I know you're going to be tasked with that when you get here.
Thank you. Done a couple of tasks for you already, which I...
We're just going to have a Canadian flag and a keg, and he's just going to be handing out solo cups for $3.
People don't realize what it takes to put on a show of this magnitude. I mean, This is... You're talking thousands of models on display.
Thousands of man hours of prep, too.
Thousands of man hours, and you're not getting paid for this.
No. No, we're not.
You're not making money. I mean, it's like the amount of time. I mean, it takes a year to or more. You're prepping this before the other show was even started. The show before you was even started.
We pitched in Omaha and got the bid in Omaha, and then a full year elapsed. And then we were in San Marcos, and we were at San Marcos promoting the show, which was now, you know, that was 6 months ago that we were in San Marcos.
Yeah, you guys had that table right in front of the display room.
Yep. Yep. And now we've got a 6 month window, you know, January, New Year's, basically we've got, you know, six and a half months to get everything together before we go live. I'll be honest with you. Had I known the amount of work that goes into putting a nationals together, I probably wouldn't have done it.
I told you this at the time.
I probably wouldn't have done it, but everybody says, you know, it's like skydiving. You got to try it at least once, you know, and then you decide if you like it or not.
The idea is, though, that you actually want to generate some revenue from this, obviously, right?
Right. And we will. Knock on wood, our projections have been good so far, even with our expenses and where we want to be with certain things. We've hit our marks. So I'm not going to spend X and then realize that we don't make that back, you know, in terms of our numbers. And overwhelming majority of the revenue is made from vendor tables, the sale of vendor tables, and obviously, you know, people showing up and registering. There are a whole bunch of other intangibles that come into play, such as food and beverage. You know, if everybody buys a certain amount of food and beverage while we're at the show, eventually at the end of the day, when they're tallying it all up, the venue will actually take money off our bill for the facilities charge.
Did you see when they were charging $40 for those box lunches?
Yeah, that's not going
to
happen.
To start with. And then by the end of day one, they were like, $8, just take it.
Because they didn't want to throw them away. I mean,
right.
You know, yeah. And let me kind of throw this out there, because there have been a lot of people that have attended the national convention who, for whatever reason, jump on the show. They didn't have a good time. They this, that, whatever happened. If people knew the amount of work that actually went into making this event happen, I think they'd probably be a little more forgiving and a little more understanding. No matter how good a job you do, it's never going to be perfect. There's always going to be some hiccup. Hopefully it's a minor hiccup that nobody, you know, on the main floor sees, that it's something that we can fix and address behind the scenes and it goes unnoticed. There's always going to be something.
Absolutely.
For me, it was getting stuck at the venue because everybody had gone to a barbecue. And there I am standing outside at 11 o'clock at night waiting for somebody to come pick me up. And I had COVID and nobody knew where the hell I was. And there's always going to be hiccups. That is inevitable, especially when you have that many people in one place and that much going on. And we have 1,001 things going on.
Jeff, you were at the barbecue.
Was I?
Yes. You overdosed on fucking NyQuil and Sudafed and shit, and you were fucked.
That's right. I remember. Kind of remember that. Yeah, it was bad. It was bad. I was sick for weeks after I got home. So, yeah, but I mean, Madison, we've got a phenomenal venue. I think that anyone who goes to the contest and then decides, hey, let's go out and have a beer or let's go grab dinner after the show is over, is going to be just blown away because we're right on Capitol Square. It's the heart of the city. Everything that happens in Madison happens on Capitol Square. And we got a few surprises in store. There's going to be a few things that are going to be going on after hours, meet and greets and things of that nature. I can say I don't know who has been booked yet, but we got a concert. We got a concert on the rooftop on Thursday night.
What?
Be real. Yeah, fine. We got a full-blown concert. I don't know yet. It's being done. Well, it's not through us.
It's Taylor Swift.
Dear God, don't get me going on her.
Well, listen, you're surrounding yourself with a good group of guys that know what they're doing, that takes a lot of the weight off of your shoulders to put on a good show.
Absolutely.
I wish I could be there. I'm going to see you at South Bend for the Amps Nationals.
Yep.
That's as far west as I'm going to get. I'm going to miss out on this IPMS Nationals, but,
you know, we should get you to come out to the Nationals.
God willing, if I'm still alive, I'll be at the Virginia one in 2025. That's the best I can do. Right, Rob Adams?
I suppose. I got to fucking fly everywhere to get to these things, and you can't?
I don't fly.
It's only a 2.5-hour flight from...
I don't fly. Oh. Dude, you got to B.A. Baracus me if I got to go on that plane.
I was just
going
to say, it's like having Mr. T in the thing.
I need to drink a bottle of Jack and a couple of Xanax, and I might be able to do it.
Well, whatever it takes, man, you got to fucking sacrifice.
Tucci, if I put Riv in a headlock and put him in a sleeper hole, do you think we can keep him sedated for 4 months and then just put him on a plane back in July?
Oh, I think it's possible. Anything's possible these days with him.
Yeah, we'll just slip him a roofie and off he'll go.
Yeah.
Why's my ass hurt me so bad?
Why am I in Hawaii and where are my pants?
My ass is killing me.
That sounds like a damn good time.
Like I've always said, Jeff, you do take on a lot, but I'm proud of you, man. I lost a bet. I'm out a couple of dollars. I said Jeff was going to be hightailing it out of there by now. You kept with it.
Oh, yeah. It's very rare that I quit. I will blow things up. I will burn things to the ground. The obligation that I made to IPMS, to the organization as a whole, to the membership mostly, and then to all of my friends, they stood up and they volunteered to be a part of this team. And there is no way in hell I'm leaving any of them behind. And I'm certainly not going to take myself, you know, out of the position of being the guy that takes the brunt of everything that happens. Because the guys that work for me are just, they're too nice. And they need an asshole, you know, like me, who isn't afraid to say no, or isn't afraid to, you know, argue and yell and scream until he gets his way in order to make this show good and make this show great. And sheer force of willpower, I guess, or just me being me. Sledgehammer diplomacy, I think, is probably a good analogy. But I'm busting my ass, and so is everybody else. And we're excited about the outcome of this show. And we sincerely hope that people can, you know, put aside all the crap that's going on and just come to Madison, have a good time, hang out with your friends, party, drink beer, eat cheese curds, see lots of great models. Seminars. Good God, I think we've got like 40 seminars booked.
What?
Remember you asked me to do a photo etch one back in the day. Like, if I get the Nationals, I want you to do a photo etch seminar.
Yeah, I would put you on the list, but you're not going to fly out here. So,
nah,
you
know. I'm not doing it.
But yeah, so we got so much going on. We got great tours. We got a VIP tour going up to the EAA Museum in Oshkosh. We got a tour going to the Harley-Davidson Museum. For the wives and the winos in the group, we got a tour going up to Wallersheim Winery. We've even got a tour going to the Wisconsin Dells to the water park. So if you bring the kids along and you want to send the wife and the kids to the water park for the day.
Most of those guys that go to those shows should not be going to the water park. Or at least take their shirts off. They'll flood the valley.
Some of them do. Yeah.
How do the tours work? You just go up to the bus that takes you to the place you want, pay your money and go?
No, when you register for the convention, there will be little checkoff boxes that are done through registration.
But they still cost money, though, right?
Extra
money?
Yeah.
I didn't register that way. I was in with the vendors at the last one, right?
Right.
So I didn't see any of that.
We negotiated some really good deals. For example, the EAA tour. I think the EAA tour, I think it includes both lunch and a sit-down dinner and the museum tour and bus transportation, and the whole thing comes in less than $100 a head.
Oh, shit. That's pretty good.
I always said it. You always put 110% at this. If no one doesn't know Jeff Hearn, and Jeff can be a straight shooter, sometimes to his detriment, sometimes he'll tell you to go fuck yourself. Yep. He might not mean it, but...
No, I always mean it.
Okay, you always mean it.
I always mean it.
I guess those times when we got into like spats, you're like, fuck you, Riviezzo. I guess you really meant it, huh?
Yeah.
I was hoping you were just joking.
He's a man of the moment, though. It doesn't necessarily mean.
But in all honesty, we're having a good moment here. You do put 110% into things. You always will put the best that you can possibly do for something. So
thank you.
I knew that when it came to this show, I mean, it hasn't happened yet, but I know that you're doing the best you possibly can do.
Yeah.
To put on the best show possible. Same thing with everything else you've ever done. You've always done your best to make it succeed. So
I appreciate it. And, you know, I think, and with all of you guys being modelers as well, I think this, and of course, even the listeners, it will probably hit a nerve, strike home, but you can do 101 good things in this hobby. And if you do one bad thing, that is the scarlet letter around your neck for the rest of your life. You know, I always try to do the best that I can possibly do. I don't know. I mean, I don't necessarily think I'm an egotist or anything like that. I've done everything in my life that I've ever set out to do, but there's no excuse for not trying to do your best. And insofar as Madison is concerned, you know, I put my reputation on the line, and I put the reputation of my teammates on the line. So yeah, we kind of got to give it our all.
It's going to be a great show. I wish I could be there. I'll get like a half-assed report from Adams when he's there, because he'll be drunk the whole time. So he'll like message me like in some drunken stupor, or like video me, and I'll understand like every other word, but I'll know if he's having a good time.
Yeah. Well, you know, we could put you on a train.
But if I go, Henry's going to beat me up if I go there. I can't go there.
I did good show coverage the last time, man. Don't worry. I'll cover all that shit.
You did do good show coverage. And I'm glad you went last year, Adams, because I know you did well and you had a good time. And you networked a little bit, too. So it was good.
Yeah. And Jeffy and I hung out in the same house together for 4 days.
I don't even remember it.
How bad did Jeff snore?
I don't know. I wasn't in the same room as him. But the moment DJ and I showed up in the driveway, Jeff was the first one out, gave me a big hug, and then everybody in BJ decided to fight over tables and shit. And I was like, okay, this is cool. Where's my room?
Okay, so the last show that I was with Jeff was at the Amps Nationals in Newport News.
Virginia.
Right. Guys are walking around with these little, like, scale colors bottles. And they're fucking drinking. And I'm like, what is this? I don't have this. Why is everybody drinking this stuff out of, like, a scale colors bottle? And fucking somebody gives me the bottle and I look at it and I turn the label, and on the label it says Rob Riv's tolerance juice. And I'm like, what the fuck is this? Shit. I open it up. They put fucking whiskey in this freaking scale colors. He brought like 100 bottles of scale colors and he was distributing to people. Anytime I was somewhere, these people were drinking this whiskey out of these scale color bottles that said Rob Riv tolerance juice, just so they could bear, like, to hang out with me. They had to drink this whiskey.
Understandable.
No one offered it to me. I'm like, I didn't realize it. Because
I wouldn't have done anything. That wouldn't have had the effect.
The crazy shit was is they were doing it since Friday. I didn't realize what was going on until like Thursday. I didn't realize what was going on until the Friday.
We started Wednesday night when we were setting up. So,
oh my God, dude, that was so funny, man. That was funny stuff, dude. Ugh.
God. That was Johnny Walker Black Label too, man. That was some good stuff.
Oh, Johnny Walker. I see. I said whiskey. Yeah. It was scotch. Yeah.
Scotch.
Scotch is a whiskey.
Yeah.
Scotch is a whiskey.
Johnny Walker Black Label.
Could have been Johnny Walker Blue.
Steve, was it? No, you didn't go. You weren't in Virginia Beach.
I got mine though. You sent
you
me
did?
One.
Did you?
Oh, okay. Yeah. It went fast.
I can't remember who it was. Maybe it may have been Sacklin. It may have been somebody else. But literally, we're just sitting at the table and somebody would just reach over and slap me on the shoulder, and I'd just reach and hand him a bottle.
You tell them you want the bottles back because, I mean, it's got enough alcohol in there. They're sanitized, right?
Yeah. Hey, they're clean.
You can reuse those shit. You know, it's like when someone gives you canned goods and they're like, can I have the, I want the jar back. You can get all the pickles, but I want the fucking jar back.
You know what? You're going to be in South Bend. I think it behooves us to kind of rekindle that tradition.
What, we the should. Rob Roof's tolerance juice?
Yeah.
Make the bottles bigger, man.
The funny thing about that was that I didn't know anything about it. No one told me. So I just see people drinking at these scale color bottles. What the fuck are these guys drinking? It was funny, man.
Paint them.
And then Jeff got mad because we took a group photo outside, everybody, but Jeff wasn't in the photo. I'm like, yeah. Fucking vending, man. What do you want me to tell you?
I had somebody working with me. You could have called me. And it was literally like 50 feet from my table.
We're all waving to you while we were taking a picture.
Yeah, yeah.
Good time. That was a good time, though. All right. So I'm glad we touched base on this. This was a good conversation about the Nationals, but we're going to get into the businesses for Jeff and what Jeff does on the business side of the hobby. So
Jeff, you had mentioned in your origin story that Justin pulled out of you that you had started with pigments for weathering. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is that now talk? Can you talk a little about that part of the business and why you gravitated to that? And then what took you from there to jumping into your present endeavor, scale colors?
Yeah, the pigments, I can blame it all on MIG. Way back in the day, I bought a bottle of MIG pigments, and I used probably the incorrect binder for it, and it turned my dark gray pigment purple on the model. There's some sort of chemical reaction. It could have been the underlying paint code. It could have been whatever, and it pissed me off. So I started looking around. And I said, there's got to be a better way to do this. And sure enough, I stumbled onto a website where these guys mix their own oil paint. Regular artists, you know, guys that do portraits on canvas and stuff like that. And I read this paper about how these guys make their own oil paints and where they source their artist pigments from. And I thought, you know, that might be a good idea. So I go online, I find this website, and I order a sample packet of basic ochres and oxide colors and started messing around with them. And I suddenly realized that, wow, this is really cool stuff. And I said, you know, shit, I could market this. I could sell this to modelers. And I think it's a better product because it doesn't have any binding agents or anything else in it. It's just literally sterilized colored dirt. So I started buying pigments in bulk, kilograms at a time. Everything was great until the first shipment of white pigment showed up and it was in these kilo bread loaf size bags.
Look like a bunch of blow or what?
Exactly. I mean, you know, and then the yellow ochre shows up and, you know, one of the guys from the club goes, dude, is that what I think it is? It's like, yeah, heroin. So then we started packaging this stuff and promoting it. And, you know, suddenly, wow, sales took off. And then I got into washes and started doing the washes. And that sold for a while. I was still working in the mining industry at that point in time.
So that wasn't scale colors at the time at all?
No, it was War Pigs.
War Pigs, okay.
It was War Pigs, and the LLC that I had set up was Modeler's Warehouse. And the goal, the long game, was that I was eventually going to just have all of these different modeling products kind of under one brand. Then War Pigs fell on some difficulty, and then the car accident happened. I just let it go. You know, I couldn't function. I was basically a zombie for the better part of a year and a half. Between the brain swelling and the medication and everything else, it was just, I was non-functional. So after that started to clear up, I said, okay, I'm going to revive the pigments. I'm going to revive the washes, but what's next? You know, where can I take this to the next level so that I can do this full time? And that was Scale Colors. I was fortunate because it happened about a year before COVID hit. Well, we started formulation of the paint, I think in 2016, 2017, we launched late 2017. So I spent a whole year in R&D working on the formula for the paint. And then we sold for about a year and things were okay. And then COVID hit and it blew up. It just went right through the roof because nobody could go anywhere. Nobody could do anything, you know, and people fell back on their hobbies. And it was right around that same time that testers went away. So all of the naval colors that testers had produced, we call them the 5 series colors, 5H haze gray, 5O ocean gray, 5N navy blue. All those colors went away in both the acryl and the enamel line. So ship modelers were screaming. So I said, okay, there's a need, there's a niche, and I'm going to fill it. you know, I went from making just above minimum wage in the first year that I was doing it to triple digits, six digits by the time COVID was over. Had a couple of banner years. And there's ups and downs with it, you know, like anything else. You know, it's cyclical. So some months are, you know, fantastic, and in other months I'm scraping together nickels. So that kind of segued into the tracks. I made the decision to kind of get into 3D printing and started messing around with it at a point in time where no one else had really, you know, BJ DeBecker from Panzer Concepts was probably the only guy at that point when I first started that was truly pushing 3D printing. And by the time I got up to speed being self-taught, there were all kinds of guys, Louis Vargas and BJ, and then all the groups started popping up, the 3D print groups and things of that nature. And it snowballed considerably. I'm not putting as much emphasis on the 3D tracks as I was now because the curve has just skyrocketed. Everybody's got a 3D printer now. But there's still a market that I can cater to, and that's the modeler who doesn't have a 3D printer, the modeler who doesn't have the ability to design something for himself. So there's still a niche market there, and that's kind of where I've been trying to fit in, you know, with the tracks. And it's been great. I mean, I have 8 printers running 24/7. And I can't keep up.
I was there the day the 3D printing saga commenced for you.
You were
doing that Geschützwagen and you couldn't get tracks.
Yep.
And you're like, fuck it. I'm going to make my own tracks. And you sat there and you made your own. Am I right about that?
You are absolutely right.
That Geschützwagen got thrown in the trash.
It did.
We were all in the build room and you hear, boom. And we're like, what the fuck was that? Typical Jeff Hearn comes back in front of the camera, sweating. And I'm like, what the hell is happening? Like, I just fucking threw that thing in the trash. Fuck it.
Yep.
And then like 4 days later, you're like, the Geschützwagen is out of the trash. I'm resurrecting it.
I felt bad because that model was a gift. Brett Dillenbeck actually gave me that model. It was a gift.
I also remember when that happened.
Those were the first tracks you made.
Those were the very first tracks I made. They were King Tiger tracks.
Right. Then you started making a couple of other tracks, and you, and not that we didn't know BJ. We weren't friendly with BJ at the time. Of course, we knew of BJ.
Right.
And you wanted to make, if my memory serves correct, Sherman tracks.
I did. But
the Sherman tracks that you were going to make, or you were making, BJ just had them available on Colts, whatever it's called.
Yeah, Colts 3D.
Colts, yeah.
Yep.
So you're like, I can't sell tracks that are now available on Colts.
Right.
And then I remember you contacted BJ.
Right.
And that's how you guys kind of like hit it off. And then all of a sudden BJ came around and was part of the group.
What ended up happening was I was developing a set of Sherman tracks. And little did I know that there's like 11 different types of Sherman tracks. I was just... You get your education as you go, you know, when you're doing your R&D. And BJ had put his tracks up on Cults 3D and had made the announcement that they were up there for people to download and print. And I was literally getting ready to drop my set of Sherman tracks like 2 days later. And it bothered me because I didn't want anyone to think that I had just grabbed his 3D model and had started producing him. So I contacted BJ and said, look, you know, I've been working on this. Here's my model files. I actually sent him my STLs. I said, I want you to understand that I developed these and I was planning on releasing them. And I just wanted you to know that they're not your tracks. They're different. And he looked at them and he's like, well, why are you doing them that way? You're never going to get consistency if you print them that way. You need to print them this way because I've already tried it. I've already failed. And this design works. And I'm like, okay, great. Back to the drawing board. And he's like, dude, just use mine. And the next thing I know, Messenger, you know, is slashing and he's sending me all of these STL files.
Great guy.
And I said, well, look, because I'm doing this for a living, I've got to make that distinction clear. So when you buy a set of Sherman tracks from me and you look at the side of the box, it says manufactured under license from Panzer Concepts. And there's a little thank you on the box that says.
Right. I remember that.
Thanks to BJ DeBecker. On the front, it's modeled by 3D modeled by Panzer Concepts. And I've kept that on all of my Sherman tracks, with the exceptions of the ones that I've, you know, gone on later on and designed myself, the T66 tracks and T74s, T62s. I don't think those were initially in his design. And then I made a few edits. I called him up and said, hey, you know, I want to do a set of T48 tracks that are worn down. you know, his tracks were brand new, you know, with the real thick chevron. Said, I want to kind of round them off and make them shallower. And oh, by the way, here's the file. So if you want to put it up on Cults 3D, I'm all for file sharing. That was how that all came out and came to be. By the time I had done the Sherman series, I had already done Tiger 1s and Tiger 2s, T-34s, and I had been messing around with the Panzer 3-4 designs, which at the time when I started were really finicky. When I started with this, what, 2 years ago, I was printing on 2K printers, and now 2K printers are paperweights. We got 12K printers that are out there now. So I had to kind of engineer the tracks to be able to print on the machines that I had at the time. So now, you know, I'm looking at 42 different SKUs in the SC3D line. So all of the Sherman tracks, obviously. Now I've started branching off into a lot of one-off stuff. OMSH for the T-55 series.
Did you ever do the Merkava?
They are on the short list.
Yeah.
They're actually next. I just picked up a Merkava 6 that I need to fit tracks to.
Don't forget about the Border Models one that's coming out too.
Well, I got to get my hands on it before I can.
Nobody has their hands on it yet.
It's got to be nice getting tracks from Jeff.
It is nice getting tracks from Jeff. They're good. I like them.
I'm breaking his balls. What I want to ask is this, and I don't know if Tooch has this question, but this is my interjection. I was always amazed how quickly, like all of a sudden, there you are drawing CAD and making these files. Like, where did you learn how to use whatever you use?
Fusion 360. So
the program you use?
Yeah. And what I started doing, and BJ actually kind of pointed me in that direction. So again, he gets props for that. There is a program that Autodesk created called Tinkercad. And Tinkercad is a free online 3D modeling program. It's very basic. It's basically the Microsoft Paint of Photoshop. And when I first started working and teaching myself how CAD works and how things are manipulated and vertices and things of that nature, I told myself going in that I can't jump in over my head. So the first thing I started doing was making crates and boxes and simple stuff that anybody could do. And the interface was intuitive and I got real good at it. And then I started doing a couple of different track designs and I got real good at using Tinkercad. And then suddenly I got to the point where it wasn't doing what I needed it to do. And that is exactly the way Autodesk wanted it to happen. Yeah. Whoever created this concept, they start you out in Tinkercad and they give you just enough in that software to become proficient, understand manipulation, vertices, and things of that nature. And then they move you into their next project or their next product and they sell it to you a very large sum of money. So they tease you for free and then they hit you up for the subscription for Fusion 360. Once I get into Fusion 360, it's an amazing program and it does everything that I need it to do. Because let's face it, you know, I'm not designing nuclear power plants with this stuff. I mean, I'm making tank tracks.
The thing is with like any kind of learning, right? Don't take on more than you can understand at the start, right?
Yep. And I started out small. The first thing that I did was, you know, working on crates and boxes and just basic stuff that I could print. And that also at the same time kind of acclimated me to learning how the printer worked and setting up supports and exposure times and, you know, lift speeds and all those different things that I needed to learn with the printer. You got to learn how the machine works. So there's two completely separate processes that are going on.
That translates into like model building or anything, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, you want to build that giant Bismarck that I got sitting over here, but I've never built a ship yet. So not doing it.
Right there. Yep.
Yeah, right.
And the beauty of this for me was that I've never been intimidated by computers. I mean, I've been involved in the gaming industry. I've done 3D model work and stuff like that. And for the gaming industry, side projects and consulting here and there. So I've never been intimidated by the computer. So for me, this was just kind of segueing into a different medium because I already, as a modeler, scratch build stuff. I don't know if you guys have seen my half track.
Oh, hell yeah.
Scratch built a 1/6 scale half track just because I wanted to do it. So I took that same principle that I applied towards scratch building, which is to take a complex shape and break it down to its most basic components. And in the end, really, when it comes right down to it, even a complex shape is just nothing more than a collection of basic shapes and parts. So I started trying to take that same approach with 3D modeling. it was intuitive to me. It worked. And now, I mean, there are guys out there that have taken the technical college courses on 3D and they're leaps and bounds. They're light years ahead of where I am. But I do what I need to do and I can do it rather effectively. Amazingly, I haven't had anybody complain that, you know, the tracks are too big or the tracks are too small or the tracks are too thick or too thin, you know.
Yeah, but you put them through a pretty rigorous testing process before you release them.
Well, I have to.
Yeah.
You know, I made the mistake of when I did my Panther tracks, I made the mistake of putting the cleats, the little chevrons, the little diagonal chevrons. I made the mistake of putting them on the track cleat the wrong way. They were supposed to be this way and I put them that way, 90, you know.
Yeah, that's a problem.
Horizontally flipped. And then I posted up a photo and guys just jumped all over me. I mean, they were insulting my ancestors over this.
I was one of those guys. Oh, I took the chance. I was like, what an idiot.
Jesus Christ, guys, give me a fucking break here. Okay, I can fix it. Here, let me go into CAD. I grabbed those five chevrons that are on the cleat and I just flipped them so that they were in the right direction. I said, there, are you happy?
It's not like it went into fucking production yet.
Holy
or anything,
shit. Right? Guys went nuts. Okay. Way too serious.
Because I think they did go into at least an initial production because I have those Panther tracks. The first.
Do you
gen.
Have a set of the ones where they were backwards? Yeah.
Yes, I do. They're hanging. They're...
So all you do is just turn them around.
Two chances a collector's item.
Now you know why he's sending those tracks for free. You thought you were getting something good. You thought you were making good business. You got screwed in the end. I told you.
No, it's a collector's item. Fuck off.
Yeah. It's a factory misprint.
You know, that was very telling for me early on that if you do something that's even a half a millimeter off, you know, guys are going to threaten to burn your house down for crying out loud. Yeah, I have to kind of run them through the ringer to try to make sure that when they go out, they fit, they can be assembled. There's the proper number of tracks in the bag so that you have enough to do, you know, a tank of a specific type. Again, that's all part of that behind the scenes process. You know, people think I just magically push a button and out comes a set of tank tracks. And there's a lot more to it than that.
This is a question I want to ask. There's obviously a lot of research that goes into this. And like you said, the printing part is the easy part because once it's printing and then you process that, the final product. But it's the stuff that comes before it that people don't realize is where the time is. And that means money. And your time is money because I've spent many a night up late with you talking about research and not only for colors, but for tracks and accessories. You want to talk a little about what the process is that you go about? Because I know first you're a perfectionist, without a doubt. And because your name is on it and that's important, you need to be perfectionist. But you want to talk us through this whole process that you go to before you even get into a CAD design and to a final product?
There's a couple of different approaches that I take, and this is full transparency because there are...
It's us.
Well, no, but for example, my Panther tracks. Now, the Panther tracks that I released were 3D scanned from an actual Panther link. So I 3D scanned an actual one-to-one scale Panther link. Now, it was an early link that had the two cutouts. It had the flat-faced cleat with the two cutouts. The rest of the track is identical to the late war track that had the metal chevrons that were welded onto it. Where I got into trouble, I modified that 3D scan to actually be the later production track. So that's number one. If you're fortunate enough to get yourself a living sample, an artifact, and you can scan it, then all you have to worry about is scaling it to a specific model kit.
What do you use to scan it? Sorry, I'm just curious now.
A regular 3D scanner.
Like, is that something you can do on your phone, or you got to buy a separate device for that?
You got to buy a separate device. And in my case, I rented it because the scanner that I needed was, you know, way, way, way out of my price range.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. They're really expensive, right? So.
And there's a place here that in Milwaukee where you can actually go and you sign your life away and you offer them a kidney in exchange, but they loan you a 3D scanner. You go do what you got to do, and then, you know, you go back to work.
Okay, that's cool.
So that was how the Panther tracks came into being. And then you have to scale them to fit a particular kit, because contrary to popular belief, if you scan an actual Panther track link, it doesn't fit Tamiya and it doesn't fit Dragon. You know, there's little nuances. You would think that the part would actually fit because you're scanning it from the original. Well, that comes from the guys who were engineering the drive sprockets in the kits and spacing and the thickness of the drive sprocket teeth and things like that. So little things like that need to be tweaked. That's version number one. Version number two is taking a kit track and actually replicating the kit track via parts and bits in CAD. I did that with my KV series and my IS-1, IS-2 JSU series of tracks that I did that Neil Stokes helped me on. He provided me with line drawings, and then I used kit tracks basically to gather dimensions, match them up against the drawings that Neil provided me with, and you kind of amalgamate those into a working model. That's version number two. Version number three is just scratch right from the very beginning and working off a set of line drawings. I did that with the M18 Hellcat tracks. I had nothing to work on. All I had was a set of line drawings in a David Doyle book. And I made the model. I had to scale the 3D model to fit the physical plastic model, and then matched them up against the kit tracks. And eventually you come together with something that then you have to engineer the parts to actually be pinned and fit together. And then you got to engineer the pins to go in the links and things of that nature. So it's not a snap your fingers process. For me to design a track, obviously, if I can get my hands on an artifact and scan an original, that saves me probably 30, 40, 50 hours of design work. If I have to do it the second way, I can typically prototype a link in 12 to 24 hours. And if I have to do it from scratch, that gets up into the 30, 40, 50 hour range, you know, because you want to make sure that it's right. When you look at a tank track, it's actually a very complex structure, regardless of what track it is. I mean, even the flat plate T-34 tracks are a very complex structure in terms of the cleat design and the ribs and how the casting, you know, the cutouts for the castings and curvatures of the castings and things of that nature. So you got to make sure you get that right, because if you get it wrong, somebody will call you out on it.
The internet is there.
Well, you're a one-man operation, so you make a set of tracks. You got to take off all the trees off of the tracks, clean mm-hmm. them up, count them out, put them in a bag, print out the pins and put them in a bag.
Yep.
Christ, how long does it take to package one set of tracks, let's say, for like a Panther?
Post-processing from the time it comes off the printer to packaging and putting it in a box and shipping it to a customer, every set of tracks is probably about 45 minutes to an hour's worth of work.
One set?
One set.
It's fucking a lot of work, man. How many sets of tracks do you have now in the catalog?
I think there's like 36 sets of tracks, and then there's a bunch of miscellaneous SKUs for things like, you know, no-tech and Bosch headlights and tool clasps and, you know, things like that.
So if you took your track links and just left them on the build plate,
mm-hmm.
I know that takes up more packaging, but it would save you time, right?
It would, but what ends up happening is I then have to rely on the customer to remove them from the build plate.
Right.
And if you get somebody with two right thumbs, you end up breaking more track links than you can actually use. And then I've got to spend, you know, more time, more effort, more money to get them replacement tracks. So by taking the tracks off the build plates, it allows me to quality control those tracks before they go into the package.
Okay. Yeah, like, I mean, it's 6.5 one dozen the other, right? A little bit.
One of the biggest compliments that I've gotten from people is that when they open up the tracks and they start using them, that there's no cleanup involved.
Very little.
They put the two links together, they put the pin in, and they're off to the races.
Yeah, it's very little. I mean, it's like the Fruel of the old days when they had good castings.
Yeah, I mean, I have to take pride in that, but I also have to try to do it better than everybody else does. Otherwise, you're just another guy producing tracks or parts or what have you.
And how do you set your brand apart from everyone else when everybody's doing the same shit?
Yeah, and I have to credit Steve Munzel.
Hell yeah.
Who's a very dear friend of mine. You know, he and I were talking about this way back in the day because I had done some 3D modeling.
Utensils.
Yeah, frying pans.
Yeah.
He's so happy over the damn frying pans. I said, you know, why do you do what you do with Value Gear? What's your motivation? And he said, I want to put the fun back in modeling. I don't want it to be tedious. And I said, oh, can I use that? And he's like, absolutely.
Well, but that's Steve, though, man. I mean, if you're not having a good time with that man and his presence every time you're together, you know, that guy just loves life. And it's just, he's just, it's infectious with him.
So that kind of became my goal with the tracks, was that I've done Friel tracks. And I've driven that wire 4 millimeters into my fingertip, or I've been drilling out the links and run the pin drill through the top of my finger. It's not fun. It's tedious. It's hard work. So I wanted something that when I designed it was going to be straightforward. And for the most part, with a few notable exceptions because of the complexity, you can build a full set of my tracks in probably an hour, hour and a half at the most.
I did. I did it with the Panther and I did it with the Tiger tracks.
Yeah.
And that did put, like Steve Munzel said, it did put the fun back into it. I've done the Fruel. I've been Master Club for a 35T, and it was like 2 weeks doing that.
And they're workable, which gives you a lot more flexibility when it comes to painting, when you can install them, all of the rest of it.
Yeah.
I will choose workable tracks every time.
Right.
Not because I want to pose my tank doing all kinds of weird shit. It's because I want to be able to pull them off and on.
Right.
And paint them separately. That's yeah. why.
And that was part of my goal. That was my mission, was to make them as simple and as easy to put together and as painless as possible. That's the number one thing that I hear, is how easy they go together. And, you know, guys actually enjoy building these tracks. And compared to what we used to do, or what we've had to do in the past, and even what we do with some manufacturers that are out there now that are direct competitors, you know, I take pride in the fact that I have the most fun tracks to build because I've engineered them to be that way. Are they 101% accurate compared to the... Probably not.
They don't have to be exactly accurate, though.
There's trade-offs, though, man.
Yeah, well, and in some instances, because of engineering constraints, you have to. I mean, you know, my Panzer 3-4 tracks, if I had manufactured and engineered those to match the actual originals, they'd be so fragile you couldn't put pins in them. So you have to kind of work within the parameters of what you can do in terms of print resolution and engineering.
Fruel tracks aside, the way I build, I hoarded model casting tracks back in the day because they weren't always easy to get.
They were the benchmark.
They were the benchmark. And you know what? You want to build like SK-18 tracks, which are their Panzer 3-4 tracks with the hollow guard horns.
Yeah.
You literally have to clip each track off those sprues. And then you also have to clip the guard horn off the sprue and glue the guard horns on. It would take you hours to put a set of tracks together. And I still have tons of those tracks.
Meng and TACOM came up with solutions for that. Like I did the TACOM full interior. And they would give you, you know, six guide horns. They're hollowed out. It sits in a jig. So you could do six at a time or whatever,
six at a time, but not model casting, though.
That's pretty tedious. Hollow guide horns are a pain in the ass.
But SC3D, I've got hollow guide horns and you get them in one link.
Dude, you started to put the guide horns on all the Tiger tracks in model casting. They're all freaking separate too.
Yep.
And this is injection molded.
The Trumpeter 1/16 King Tiger, the links come with the guide horns, but they're not hollow. Are they supposed to be?
King Tiger guide horns are not hollow.
No, they're solid.
All right. Okay, so they're good. The 1/16 Trumpeter Panther that I had to do was the same way. I had to glue each guide horn individually. There was no jig for that either. So
I had a guy who bought my Panther tracks, and he messaged me and he said, hey, I want to talk to you about your Panther tracks. And I'm like, okay, here we go. What's wrong? And he said, I had to get in there with my Optivisor, and I noticed that you actually put the bracing on the inside of the guide horn. And I'm like, well, why wouldn't I? It's there. And he's like, no one does that. There are no other tracks that have that internal bracing on the inside of the guide horn. And I'm like, well, okay, you're welcome. Thank you.
And that's the beauty of 3D printing.
That's the beauty of 3D printing.
Well, you could do that in styrene, but it would require slide molding every piece.
Right.
Which nobody wants to pay for.
No. 3D printing is revolutionizing the hobby, much in the same way that photo etch, you know, metal revolutionized the hobby.
No, what are you saying? let's not have this fucking debate now, for Christ's sake. I got crucified.
We're not getting into the photo etch debate, motherfucker.
No, we're not. But I mean, you know, 3D printing is going to have, if it hasn't already, had the same impact that photo etch had on the hobby.
No, I agree with that.
The same impact that, you know, airbrushing had on the hobby. You go back and you look at a plastic model that was built in 1950 or 55, 56 when they first started coming out by someone who knew what they were doing. And you compare it to an average airbrush model today, it's light years difference. Time marches on. And where do we go from 3D printing? I jokingly said at one point in time, long before 3D printing ever became a thing, was that one day you were going to buy a kit and the kit was going to have decals, clear parts, some photo etch parts, and a flash drive. And you were going to plug that flash drive into your computer. You're going to be able to print whatever parts you wanted. This was before 3D printing was even realized as a technology. And I'm talking going back to probably 2002, 2003 when I made that statement. And lo and behold, here we are.
I would say when everything becomes absolutely plug and play, then that will be a reality. But
yeah,
it's still not there yet. You still need to know a lot of different shit.
Since we're going on record here, here's what I see happening is at some point in the near future, you're going to go to your computer and you're going to say to Google, Google, 3D print me a Focke-Wulf 190 A5 in 1/32 scale. And AI is going to go out and it's going to grab the files that it needs and it's going to send that stuff to your printer. And the next thing you know, your printer is going to be chugging away, printing you an airplane or a tank or a car.
Every time I hear AI, I'm like, has nobody watched Terminator?
Yeah.
Has nobody watched that fucking movie?
Yeah.
Right.
I watched it for Sarah Connor.
Jeff, so that's great. You know, having done all that background work, let's bring it to this. What has been the best part of the 3D printing process that you've enjoyed the most?
There are two things, and one's kind of selfish and the other is just kind of motivational, I guess you could say. The selfish part is when somebody, you know, sends me a note or sends me a photo of something that they've done, you know, where they've used my tracks and said, hey, these are your tracks. And they look spectacular. And I still have a hard time wrapping my head around the fact that even though I produce the stuff, there are people out there who do finishing work and weathering work and stuff like using my own stuff that I can't do. So I'm kind of living vicariously through my customers a lot of times because I don't have the time to put, you know, to suspend at the bench like I used to. My hobby has sadly kind of gone away because my job is now my hobby and my hobby is now my job. But personally, I love doing the research. I love doing the CAD engineering and actually designing the parts in 3D and then putting them on the printer and actually seeing a tangible product come out the other end. That to me is, again, it's kind of vicariously living through my customers in a lot of ways, but you know, the creation of the 3D model and then seeing it come off the printer, it kind of fulfills that same need, you know, of building and finishing a model on the workbench, you know. So I'm still modeling a lot, but I've changed the medium. It's very rare that I get the opportunity to work in plastic anymore. Now I'm working in pixels.
But now you're scratch building.
Yeah, I'm scratch. Right? Well, I've been doing that for a long time anyway. I mean, I've been doing this hobby nonstop since I was 12 years old at the rabid level that we all kind of do the hobby. And got to that point where building a kit wasn't very exciting anymore. So in just by nature of my personality, I always try to do things that are bigger and crazier and wilder. And, you know, that's why I did a 1/6 scale half track.
The thing is like, would you call that an evolution of the hobby? Because, you know, you're not getting to sit at the bench anymore and actually enjoy it. You're building it for other people's enjoyment. So is that just an evolution of the hobby?
For me, I think it's kind of a parallelism because sitting at the computer designing a product kind of fulfills that need for me to be creative because I think we all have that as modelers. We like to create, right. We like to build things. For me, it's kind of one and the same. And the fact that I made the decision so many years ago to turn this into my job kind of kills two birds with one stone. I get the creativity and the enjoyment out of physically building something. And then I get the added bonus of being able to put it into production and sell it, make a profit, make a living, and have other people enjoy it and have other people benefit from it as well. So it's kind of a balancing act for me, but I'll be perfectly honest. I mean, just like anything else, there are times when you just say, you know what, I don't want to be at the bench tonight. You know, and you go and play a video game or you go and you watch a movie. And there are times when I don't want to be designing parts. There are times when I don't want to do anything that has, you know, scale colors attached to it. There are times when I just want to sit at the bench, be mindless, sand on plastic and just kind of, you know, detach from the world. I've been trying to make time to do that, especially in light of everything that's going on now in terms of getting ready for Madison and running a business and
clearly, there's no time for anything else when you're doing that. So, but it's like commission builders, they burn out.
Been there, done that, stopped doing it a long time ago.
Yeah, and most do, some don't, and those are the miserable ones. And
yep, for a very long period of time, I made a living at doing commission models. You know, I did contract work with Lockheed. I did work for DOD. I did work for museums. I have models in museums all over the world. And eventually, you know, you start to think, okay, I can make more money if I started doing this stuff for private collectors and whatnot. And the minute you start working for guys who want you to build a model for them, they get picky and you get frustrated and you get angry. And eventually it just kills the whole thing.
So that's probably a topic for another show, but yeah. It can be a destroyer of everything, right?
As can being in business. I mean, of all people, my wife has said to me, you know, you need to differentiate your hobby from your job.
That's the whole point of it, isn't it? So that you can de-stress from life.
Nothing kills the hobby for people than commission work.
Right.
Commission work is always seems, oh yeah, I'm going to get paid. Like, you don't realize. I said this to somebody, you know who I'm talking about. Someone wants you to build a model and you say, oh, I'll do it for $600. Seems like a lot of money. But you don't realize the kit's costing you X amount of dollars. The aftermarket's costing you this. This is happening. And then before you know it, it just took you 45 hours to build this model. And you're like, holy shit, I just worked for fucking $2 an hour. Right. That's what it comes out to be.
And when you actually figure out your time.
Yeah, it's not worth it.
You might as well be in Cambodia.
And you're not building something that you have interest in most of the time.
Where it ended for me, I had this nice little racket going. I had probably 24, maybe 30 people who had bought from me as private collectors. And actually a couple of high profile guys, a couple of guys that were professional baseball players and one professional hockey player and whatnot.
What, buy Navy ships?
Anything and everything. Okay. Aircraft, all right. Armor, cars. I'm a whore. You pay me money, I'll build you anything you want. What I would do is I would build whatever the hell I wanted. And then I had this list of these clients who had bought work from me before. And I'd kind of run my own little private art auctions via email. So I'd send everybody a whole bunch of pictures and say, you do a reply all, that's part of the agreement. You know, if you want the model, you bid on it. And when you do a reply all, everybody gets it. So you check your email. And if, you know, one guy says, I'll bid 500. The next guy says, you know what? I want it. I'm going to bid 550. Next guy says, I'll bid 6. Next guy says, I'll bid 7. I had a few that didn't get any bids. I had a few that made my entire year. So that was kind of the racket that I had going. And then, of course, relocating from the East Coast to the Midwest and taking a job with Finescale kind of curtailed that. And it was kind of viewed as a conflict of interest, me kind of doing the model auctions while working for a company that was promoting the models and whatnot. So I just kind of gave up on it.
I don't really see that as a conflict of interest.
At one point, when I first started working for Finescale, they didn't want me to compete. They wouldn't let me compete at shows.
I'll always remember, Jeff. You got to remember this because it was you and you did the magazine. Do you remember when Finescale put like the family portrait of you guys in there? It was like the whole like editorial team.
Horrible.
And there you are. It was the fucking funniest thing ever. Please, somebody who's ever listening to this, I need you to find that issue, take a picture of it, and post it. The picture, your hair was like parted.
Oh, yeah, it was horrible. I was trying to find something that worked after years and years of brush cuts.
You're wearing like a fucking polo shirt.
Oh, it was horrible. Yeah,
I remember that. That had to be like what, like in the early 2000s?
Yeah, 2004, 2005.
Oh, my God. That was the funniest picture. It was. You know what it looked like? You look like Will Ferrell in the Step Brothers picture on like the box art when they're like taking the picture of the family. Yeah. That was Jeff Hearn.
It was bad. Yeah. Well, I'll be honest with you, though. Nobody paid any attention to me because
there's that chick in there.
The intern that we had working for us, everybody was all excited about her.
That was so funny, Jeff.
I'm going to go look for that photo because I had a lady at my club drop off 20 fucking something years of Finescale Modeler. I've got it somewhere.
Save the 04 to 06 issues because I think I had like 7 covers. I think I've been on the cover of Finescale like 7 times.
I remember the 1/16 scale T-34 you did, right? Terrible job. How did that make the cover?
Well, you know, I knew a guy.
I'm only kidding. It was good.
I knew a guy.
For you.
But yeah, I think I had like 7 covers or something like that.
Oh yeah, just keep bragging. I had 7.
No. Because you look at like Paul Boyer. You know, Paul Boyer's had like 600 covers.
Nah, he was good shit. He did good stuff.
And Paul's a phenomenal modeler, phenomenal guy.
So let's talk about your Nationals wins too. How did you do there?
Right after I left Finescale, there was a moratorium on me competing. And they said that they felt it would not be appropriate if a staff member at Finescale actually won at a competition, to which my argument was I was winning at competitions before I came to Finescale. And I've got the track record to prove it. So, you know, if anything, I think it kind of boosts our credibility as a magazine, because then you can then spin it and say, you know, our staff are award-winning modelers.
Yeah.
They didn't buy it, so I wasn't allowed to compete when I was there.
I got to ask this question. Finescale don't solicit articles, right? Because you could just submit an article to Finescale. They'll take the article. They might run it. They might not.
And again, maybe we'll head off on that tangent in a little bit. But, you know, if it's a good enough article and it's well-written, even if it's not well-written, I've edited some absolute doozies. I actually edited an article for Finescale that went into print. The photos were great, but the manuscript was actually written on a napkin.
It's probably Steve Andriano, because his articles are always fucking horrible.
You know, it might have been. I'm going to have to go back and look through it.
Actually, when I see Steve's writing, he's very eloquent with his speech.
No, he writes good.
Back to Nationals wins. So yeah, I wasn't allowed to compete. And 2007 comes along, I'm no longer with Finescale Modeler. And the first thing that I did was I said, all right, game on, bitches. And I brought two models to the Nationals out in Orange County. And I came home with a first and a third. You know, I think I proved my point. Nobody cares. Nobody remembers. I still got them hanging on the wall. But, you know, whoop-de-doo.
A little disappointed about that third place, though.
Well, hey, you know, considering who I was competing against, yeah, I was happy to even be on the table with some of those.
I'm joking. A third at the Nationals is a great accomplishment for you.
For me.
I'll tell you, like, for anybody that's never been there and seen something that's that big.
A sea of models.
It's just fucking huge.
We talked about it before. We did the percentages of how many people don't win anything that go to those shows. It's like 90-something percent of people don't go to those shows. It's not coming home with anything.
Right.
Crazy.
So from that point on, I've never competed at a national since.
Really?
I've gone to a lot of them, but I've never bothered to compete because it was one of those things where I won a first and a third in two different categories. I brought two models. I was two for two. What's next? You know, okay, now I'm going to go after best in class or best ship or whatever. Or what are my chances of, you know, judges best in show? A snowball's chance in hell. I will never, ever, ever in my lifetime win a judge's best in show at a national convention. So at that point, I said, you know what? I set out to do what I wanted to do. I wanted to place at a nationals, and I did that. Anything that I do from this point on, the bar is so high with the quality of work and the skills of the modelers that are out there today that anything that I try to do is just going to be a disappointment. So I set myself up for failure.
We don't agree on a lot of things, Jeff, but on that note, we agree. I agree with you 100%.
You know,
comes a point where how much you need to do, like how much is enough, you know?
And I have said that to people, interviews and podcasts and things like that. It's like, look, I've placed at a nationals. What more do you want me to do? What is left? If placing at a nationals isn't good enough, well, what's next? You know, you want me to win judges best of show at Scale Model Challenge or Mosan or Telford or something? It's not going to happen. So why should I exert the time, the energy, and the effort to try to compete when I know full well that I'm out of my league? And this has nothing to do with me as an individual. It's just there are so many modelers that are out there who are absolutely amazing, talented artists.
Right.
I'm from a transitional generation of modeling. You know, when I first started modeling, you know, we were still using Pactra paints and only the high-end guys had airbrushes. And I've been doing this all of my life. And there are guys who open up a kit and who are on their third or fourth model ever who are creating stuff that is just absolute world class and they're not even trying.
Yeah.
And how can I compete with that? I can't. And I choose not to.
You saw how excited I was when I won something there. I was like, motherfucker, holy shit.
Well, that's because you were the only guy in the category.
I said the same thing. I knew it. I fucking knew it.
No. I'm joking. It was a full category.
Yeah, there was three models in that category.
It was legit competition. You did not win by default. I give you that. I was just busting your chops. I'm surprised you don't have that belt buckle, like, you know, glued to your forehead.
It's right here behind the tank that won
it. There you go. Fantastic. And that was a very nicely done model. It was very well presented and well deserved. Credit where credit's due.
So now that you've talked about 3D, what you like about it, the process, let me ask you, the bread and butter, which got you restarted after Warpix, is the paint.
Is the paint, yeah.
Absolutely. And you had mentioned earlier in the conversation that you're a ship guy, so you were filling a gap in the paint industry when testers kind of ended their whole paint lines.
Yep.
So why don't you talk a little about what you do to make this, not, you know, give away the bread and butter, but to talk about what it takes for you, because I know I've talked to you about making colors and what you require because you want to be most accurate, but want to talk about the process of making paint, being accurate and all that.
And again, there's multiple processes that, just like in the 3D printing side of things, that I have to apply. And, you know, when I started Scale Colors, just covering the U.S. Navy World War II colors, I launched with 12 colors. I started Scale Colors with $700. That was the seed money that actually got this thing off the ground. And what ended up happening was those colors filled a niche, and they did it so well that I was able to kind of start doing additional colors. And for me, the research for paint colors has to be even more precise than the 3D engineering stuff that I do for the tracks. Because if you get a color wrong, boy, they don't just nail you for the color, they nail the whole brand. You know, this particular brand or that particular brand doesn't have accurate colors. You know,
right.
I have 140 different colors in production right now. And again, I'm a one-man shop. So if you buy a bottle of Scale Colors paint, 99.999% of the time, I hand-filled that bottle. I put the label on that bottle. I mixed that paint. I formulated that paint. I tinted that paint to make it what it is. So my hands are on it from time that we decide that we're going to release a new color until, you know, I put it in the box and I ship it off to the customer. So in a lot of ways, finding the research information for a specific color, that is the easiest and most effective way of getting a color done and to market. If someone says, I need FS number or RAL number, great. Those are easy. You know, I just tell the computer to mix FS36076 and it mixes FS36076.
So what, do you have a machine that has all the pigments already located and it does all that?
Yep, I do. But I only use that for my formulation and my testing. So I don't actually do my production work that way. So all of my R&D is done on a small table-sized machine. And I do all of my R&D, my color matching stuff and formulation stuff. There are databases that are out there, whichever particular company that you use. And I happen to use a Sherwin-Williams system, industrial paint system, for my color matching and for my my tinting. There are databases out there in the computer. You tell it to print an FS number, and the formulation for that color was probably done 8, 10, 12 years ago for some government contract, but it's the formulation and the mix is still sitting in the database. So that's real easy for me. Those are no-brainers. Same thing with the RAL standards. I can do probably 95% of the RAL color that have been produced.
So each one of these vials is loaded with pigments, right?
Correct. A dash of this, a shot of this, a dash of that. And
yeah, when you see a paint being actually mixed, it's like all kinds of colors going in there that you don't even
correct
think matter, right?
Yeah, you order a blue and you see yellow and green and orange and, you know, being dropped in there because it's...
Yeah, it's like, why am I always running out of magenta in my fucking printer?
That's exactly the same thing.
It provides all the colors that you need.
Except so. I use 10 different color pigments for my formulations, as opposed to just RGB for, say, your standard printer, or CMYK for your more advanced color printers. So that's the easy part. Unfortunately for me, most of the World War II colors don't have a federal standard number or an RAL number attached to them. So then I have to start working off color samples. And this is where the fun comes in for me, because you can go to the Washington Naval Yard, you can go to the National Archives in College Park, Maryland, and there are historical paint chips. There's color chips in documents, historical documents from that period. You can't obviously take those documents out of the archives. Lately, we've been able to get permission to use color matching software to put this little guy on the top of the color chip and try to get a photospectromic readout from it. But back in the old days, and you're going to laugh at this, but I used to take, when I first started doing this, I'd go to Home Depot and I'd take every paint chip that they had in the hardware store. And then I'd go to Sherwin-Williams store and I'd go to the Bear store and I'd go to Lowe's and I'd go to, you know, every place that had paint chips from different manufacturers. And I would literally go and grab every single paint chip that I could find. And then you go to the archives and you have to punch a hole. Any paperwork that you bring into the National Archives, they will either punch a hole in it or you have to punch a hole in the upper corner. And that proves that it's not a historical document. So when you come out, they're going through your papers and they're looking and everything's got a hole in the corner. That means you brought it in. Anything that doesn't have a hole in it, even if it's a blank piece of paper, suddenly that document doesn't leave. That piece of paper doesn't leave because it might be a historical document because people have been known to try to rip off the archives.
Kind of like the old version of Wikipedia.
Yeah. So I will literally go in with 10,001 different paint chips, and I'll sit down at the desk and open it up and I'll look at this color, and then I'll get out my paint chips and I'll try to find something that's close. Every once in a while you find something and it's absolutely perfect. And you look at that color and go, okay, that's U.S. Navy 5N Navy blue. And then you flip it over and you look at it and, you know, it's a Dutch Boy color. It's midnight blue from Dutch Boy. So you write on the back in a Sharpie that this is a perfect match, you know, and then you walk over and you look at it under, you know, natural sunlight, and you look at it under incandescent light, and you look at it under fluorescent light to make sure that, you know, okay, that's close enough. And then off you go. Unfortunately, you know, COVID kind of shot that in the foot because they shut the National Archives down. You couldn't travel. You couldn't get to the archives. Most of the archival staff got laid off, getting boxes pulled for research, and you never really knew where a lot of the stuff was. And the new people that came in post-COVID didn't know where anything was. So it really became a nightmare.
So do you have a piece of equipment that actually scans the color?
A photospectrometer, yes.
Okay, that's what it's called. All right. So it's the same kind of technology that a paint store would use to match paint colors.
Yep, that's right? Exactly it. And in fact, it's the same one that they use in Sherwin-Williams stores. It's the same exact unit. It's tied into their computer system and their tinting machine and their mixing machine. So what ends up happening then is they actually produce my base material for me. Now, unlike other paint manufacturers who shall go unnamed, my paint is actually specially formulated. It's different chemistry. Nobody else is making my chemistry. We spent a year and a half testing various formulations to try to make sure that we could get the balance and do all the things that we wanted it to do. So I am not using somebody else's product and then just putting my label on it.
Right.
There are certain 14 milliliter bottles of paint that you can buy, and they come in 10 different brands, and they're all produced by one company.
Well, we know that your thinner smells like almonds.
Cherries.
Well, almonds and cherries, they both smell the same.
You're stoned right now. How do you know?
Yeah, it's stoned.
It's not fucking stoned. You can smell fucking almonds and cherries, and they smell the same.
Oh, my God. Oh, you're stoned.
Yeah, dude.
No, when I'm talking like, I'm talking extract, whatever. Okay, all right.
So that's how most of the work gets done, if I have a historical sample of the color, or if somebody comes to me and says, hey, remember in the old days when Floqual made Pullman Green? Yeah. Well, you can't get it anymore. If I give you a sample of Pullman Green, can you replicate it? Sure, no problem. So they airbrush it on a piece of cardstock. I photospec it. I can match that color, no problem. Same way a paint store would match the color on your walls for your kitchen.
With your paints, I'll say, like, you did the flanker set, right?
Yep. Now, the flanker set caused a lot of controversy. Russian colors are extremely difficult to get any sort of a standardization on. There's no data out there that says it's, you know, two parts white base and two parts blue and two parts magenta. And, you know, there's nothing out there like that. And the Russians have no, to my knowledge, they have no color standards like we have. You know, we've got the FS system, and the British have the BS system. I think that's what they call it. The Germans have the RAL system. The Russians have none of that. So when I did the flanker set, and this is the fun part, because this is where you kind of have to do a bunch of different things. So the flanker set came about, and I will be perfectly honest with you. I went out and bought every competitor's flanker colors.
Including the interior cockpit color, right?
Including the interior cockpit colors. I went out and I bought all of them. And at the time, this was obviously before the war, I had contacts in Russia, and I said, if I send you a Pantone color chart, would you go down to the flanker that they have, the legacy flanker that they have sitting in the Victory Park, and match these color chips for me? And he said, sure, absolutely, no problem. So I sent him a Pantone guide. He went down there and he matched the colors. And he said, this is the color. And he took photos. You know, he held it right up against the side of the airplane and he took the photo and he sent it to me. I said, okay, then I have the Pantone guide here. So, you know, he told me that was the color. So then I've got the Pantone value. Well, from Pantone value, I can turn that into paint. So I created this set of paints and then I matched them up against everybody else. I matched them up against AK and I matched them up against Hitachi and I matched them up against whoever else made Fulcrum colors. Sukhoi. And what I found was that some guys got it right across the board. Some guys were out in left field. I don't know where the hell they got their color data. At that point, I just kind of made the decision, okay, well, you know what? I looked at six different manufacturers and four of them got that particular color right. And based off the data that I have from the actual airplane, the guy giving it to me, you know, secondhand, basically by matching against a standard, I'm going to go on the premise that that's the right color. And sometimes that's the best you can do.
And the colors are very vibrant. So with your paint, your pigments are super tight.
That's part of the chemistry process. You know, as I mentioned, we're not using a commercial off-the-shelf product as our base material. So my base material is formulated specifically for my stuff to my specs. When we started doing the testing and whatnot, my wife is a severe asthmatic. And if I spray even Tamiya paint using Tamiya thinner, she vapor locks.
Yeah, well, that's no good.
And that's not good. Alclad, if I spray Alclad in the house, I mean, I have to send her to her mother's for 2 weeks because it has that much of a negative impact on her. So when we started doing this, I talked to my paint chemist guy and he said, make a bullet list of all the things that you want. Okay, I want it to be commercially tinted. I want it to be water-based, but I want it to be hard like an enamel. I want it to be, you know, durable, far more durable than what's out there now. And I want no odor and airbrush ready.
It takes a bit to get it where it's hard. Your paint takes a little while to dry.
It does.
And that's okay. Just something that people need to be aware of.
Right. So when I put this list out there, there were like 10 things that I wanted. And he's like, you know, if we can get 4, you'll be lucky. I think we ended up nailing down like 7 different things. Because I kind of became a paint chemist at the same time because I was asking questions. Okay, you know, we tried this batch and it was okay, but what if we did this? Would we make the formula better? And sometimes he'd say no because, you know, this is a, you know, diethyl dimethyl based, you know, solvent that we're trying to use and that's not going to work because it'll curdle the paint, it'll over catalyze the paint, rah, rah, rah. And I'm like, what is a diethyl di? By the time we were done, you know, I'm saying, well, what if we use a triglyceride surfactant in this paint? Would that, you know, that's not a bad idea. So I basically taught myself to be a paint chemist at the same time. We experimented with, I'd have to go back into the little notebook that I kept, but I think it's somewhere around 400 different formulations of the paint before we got it to the point where it was reliable, it was consistent, and it gave us the things that we wanted from it. It's not going to dry as fast as a Tamiya paint will, for example.
No, but it self-levels, which is really nice.
But it levels better than anybody else's paint that's out there. And when it finally does cure, when it does catalyze, it becomes hard like an enamel. And the fact that it's airbrush ready, you know, most guys shoot between 18 and 25 PSI. You shake it up, you pour it in your airbrush, you're good to go. You clean it up with water. It doesn't have any odor other than isopropyl alcohol, which is the catalyst agent that we use to actually start the process of the paint catalyzing.
It's a little bit harder to clean out of your airbrush.
It is, but you also can't leave it in there for 2 days while you're off token behind the barn.
No, I don't ever leave my airbrush, man.
I will say this, though, Jeff. I'm going to fucking start a pot here in more ways than one.
Oh, here we go.
I like your paint. It sure as hell better than Mission Models. That's for shit sure. I said it.
That's the end of the interview. Interview over. Drop the cut. Drop the mic.
Right. Drop the mic. I don't know what his problem is with me, but he doesn't like me. And guess what? I don't like him.
I'm not trying to start shit, but I had to just break this up and add a little something to this conversation right now because I had to say that. But it's true.
We were in Chattanooga for the Nationals, and they made.
Oh, are we getting to this discussion now?
Yeah. Well, they made the mistake of putting us across from each other.
I remember when that happened when you were at the Nuga Nats, right?
Yeah, and I had guys, you know, 3 deep at my table, and he just sat across from me and just gave me glaring, dirty look, stink eyes the whole time we were there.
Got to give the old Little Rascals wave with the fingers on your chin.
Well, there were fingers involved, but it wasn't Little Rascal style.
Most people who sit across from you, Jeff, sometimes have that bewildered look. You say, this guy actually walked out of the house like this today?
Chattanooga was huge. I think I did almost $15,000 in sales at Chattanooga. Selling paint $5 a bottle, you know? So people come and go in this hobby, and their relevance is directly proportional to how they behaved in the hobby when they were here. And there are people in this hobby who don't necessarily have the world's greatest reputation. And there are people in this hobby who are some of the nicest people that you will ever meet. And I've said on numerous occasions, I would rather hang around with bad modelers who are world-class people than hang around with world-class modelers who are bad people.
Right.
Because in the end, for me, this is a hobby. You know, I do my best to keep my customers happy with the tracks and the paint. I try to go to the ends of the earth to make sure that they're happy and that they get what they want. And I fix it if it's not what they want. I'm not always the fastest because I'm one guy carrying 25 different packs. But I've always tried, my goal has always kind of been, be that guy that people want to hang around with, you know, be that friendly guy, be helpful to people and embrace what the hobby is supposed to be about. There are a lot of people who are like that. I mean, you guys are like that. And a lot of the other podcast guys that I know are like that. They're wonderful people.
Right.
Whose company I truly enjoy. And then there are people that are in this hobby that when I see them coming, I don't even want to waste my time.
You know, you've been involved with this hobby, like in life. You can't get along with everybody. You can be cordial, but personalities, you're always going to clash.
It's not. I treat people accordingly. You know, if you're nice to me, even if we disagree on something, or even if we don't like each other, if you're nice to me, I'll be nice to you.
Right.
If you get in my face, well, I can't promise that it's going to end up the way that you want it to end up. I've mellowed out quite a bit as I've gotten older. But, you know, the people who know me, most of them, I hope, like me. The rest that don't, I really don't care. I can't please
everybody. There's going to be people like you, people love you, people freaking hate you. There's nothing you can do about it.
And I'm that kind of guy that, you know, I'll do anything for anybody. If you burn a bridge, that's it. It's like a light switch. Once it's off, it's off.
I know.
We're done. And there's no going back. There's no fixing it. There's no making it better. There's no second chances.
Well, you can't be that closed-minded either, though, Jeff.
No, but you know what? I've been kicked in the face enough times in my life, like we all have. I know when the boot is coming. And 95% of the time, my gut instinct is right. And, you know, you just learn to trust that. Do the best you can and, you know, hope that you make a positive impact, have a difference. That's all you can do.
You covered so many bases, and you've covered all the topics that I was looking for that I think listeners would want to hear. You know, your origin story, who you are, what you've done. If you could sum up... Rob's always saying, you know, how have you contributed to the hobby? And obviously, you've contributed to the hobby in many ways, on a professional level, on a business level, on a hobby level, even with your involvement in IPMS. How would you sum up your participation in the hobby or your contribution to the hobby?
Well, again, I think it falls back on, you know, me kind of talking about my attitude, you know, towards people in general. And I would like to think that, you know, okay, nobody's perfect. I'd like to think that I had more of a positive impact on things than a negative impact. I'd like to think that what I have contributed to the hobby over the years, whether it be through my books or my products or my involvement with IPMS USA, to a lesser extent, my involvement with AMPS, I kind of feel bad that I haven't given those guys as much of my time and attention as I've given to IPMS over the years. I would like to think that I am leaving the hobby in a better state than when I found it, that I've kind of contributed, that I've helped people. I take a lot of pride in that. You know, the customers will call and they'll say, you know, I'm on your website and I want to order paint, but I'm building this particular model and I'm not quite sure what colors I need. And I often take for granted the fact that because I've been doing this for so long, because my area of expertise is World War II ship camouflage. This stuff is just on the top of my head. It's readily available to me. It's second nature to me. But there are people out there who have, you know, no idea what measure 31 or measure 12 colors or what ship wore what specific colors on a certain date and time. I have that information on the top of my head because I've done so much research to make these colors accurate. So to me, I get a kick out of doing that. I get a kick out of a customer hanging up and he's happy and he's excited and he's motivated because I've given him information that he didn't have. And other than him buying a couple of bottles of paint, it didn't cost him anything other than his time. And I'm not asking for anything in return. I think that there are a lot of people in this hobby who take a very mercenary approach to information and data because they feel that they can attach a dollar figure to it and earn something off it. I have tens of thousands of photos in my photo collection of World War II ships. And somebody will ask me, you know, if I have a photo of a ship, yeah, what's your email address? And I'll send it to them. To me, they're a collection of electrons. And if it's sitting in my hard drive and I don't share it, it does absolutely zero good for anyone, but you send that photo to somebody and it answers 35 questions that they have about that model that they're working on. And in a lot of instances, and you guys have all experienced it as well, many times there's an emotional attachment to it. Maybe it's your grandfather's ship, or it was your dad's airplane, or, you know, something of that nature. And you're providing them with photos for reference just because they bought a couple bottles of paint from you. But that's part of the customer service. You know, that's part of contributing. And that's the charitable side of the business that I run. The information that I have, if I know it, I'm happy to share it. I don't keep any secrets other than my paint formulas. And I think we need more of that in the hobby. I really do. I think we've become very mercenary, and we've become kind of obsessed with competition and building the world's greatest model, you know, and beating the next guy, whether it's at a model contest or getting the most likes on Facebook because you've got the best looking model in the photo gallery. None of that shit matters. Nobody cares who won that $5 trophy at the end of the day. You know, they care in the moment when everybody calls your name and you go up and, you know, 35, 40, 50 people clap for you because you took first place in a local contest. At the end of the day, nobody cares. It doesn't matter. We're not solving global crises or, you know, curing childhood diseases here. We're a bunch of grown men building plastic models. We're passionate about it. Sometimes we tend to overdo it and take it to extremes. And I think if we started to redirect our focus, and that's one of the things that I'm trying to do with the National Convention as chairman, I have that ability, I have that luxury that I don't necessarily want to make it about the contest. I don't want people to come to Madison for the contest. I want people to come to Madison to see their friends, to hang out, to have a good time, to eat good food, be entertained, and to enjoy the experience of being surrounded by people who hold the same values and the same interests. Where else but at an IPMS National Convention can you sit down at a table with 10 other guys and a bunch of beers and talk about P-51 Mustangs? And everyone is genuinely excited to be involved in the conversation. You know, that's IPMS USA, any model show, any organization, whether you are at Scale Model Challenge or Telford or Shizuoka, any of those types of events that bring us together as hobbyists, I think serve that purpose. And I think that we have lost touch with that social aspect of it. And it's going to be a difficult thing to overcome because we've been sequestered in our basements and in our workshops as individuals building models for most of our lives. And let's face it, I mean, we all know there's a lot of people who are socially inept in this hobby and hygienically inept as well. I mean, guys, you know.
I know we talk about that all the time, about like people's hygiene at a show.
Do me a favor. If you're coming to Madison for the National Convention.
Shower.
Shower, you know, buy a clean T-shirt.
Deodorant.
You know,
deodorant.
Do us all a big favor.
Non-perspirant. I don't care about the freaking, you know, lead and aluminum in the thing. Wear it.
But those are the things that I think, you know, is what make the hobby unique. We have, and I joke about this, I did it with my local club. We had 22 guys sitting around the modeling table. Two of them were doctors. One of them was a former federal prosecutor. One of them was a retired cop. Two are former military. One works in a nonprofit. One was an anesthesiologist. And two guys were homeless, living in their cars. And we're all at the model club meeting sharing the same passion and the same enjoyment and the same hobby. And for a brief modicum of time, it puts us all on the same level. No one man is better than anyone else because we're all sharing in the same hobby. And we need to get back to that. We need to emphasize. We need to promote that.
Right. And that's what our group is about. This group that we have now, the Modeling Insanity Group, that is what we promote. Having fun, enjoying the hobby, enjoying friends. And combining that all just to have a good time. That's what it's all about. And like I always say, you can take the hobby serious, but when it starts to dominate the way the hobby's done for you,
right,
you got to take a step back. That's why for me, I know I always joke around, especially on this podcast, when we're together in the build rooms or at a show or a club meeting or whatnot. It's all about having fun. And you need to do that every minute of every day when this hobby. There's too much shit going on in this world where you're going to start doing what you do on a plastic model serious.
Yeah, life is way too short, as you said. There's too many things going on in the world that are negative distractions to us. And we all do this for different reasons. You know, some of us do it for therapy. Some of us do it to distract ourselves from other demons that we may have to deal with. Some of us do it because we're bored. Some of us do it because we have a passion for the subject. I'm never going to be wealthy enough to own a P51 Mustang, but goddamn it, I have 35 of them on the shelf over there, and I can build one and put it on the shelf and admire it and know that I had a hand in creating something.
I want to touch on what you had said about how it's a solitary hobby and there's guys all over in their basements just building alone and whatnot. I kind of had an epiphany, almost like the podcasts are like the crew of the Nebuchadnezzar in The Matrix. And one by one, we're grabbing them out of their little spots and unplugging them and showing them the world as it is. We're, you know, try to wake everybody up that, look, you do this and there are others that do this too. Come join the crew.
Right. But you ate both the red pill and the blue pill, didn't you?
Yes, absolutely. So I took the purple pill.
No, I should have had to take the blue pill.
But I mean, you got to expand it. And I'm sure you've seen whenever a new episode from any of the podcasts come out, I'm sharing it all over Facebook.
Right.
Because
right.
There are people out there that they take it too seriously.
Yeah.
They take their modeling way too seriously and they need to see the community.
One of the things that we have to remember too, and I say this and people laugh at me until I explain it. We are the tip of the spear. And everyone goes, raises their eye. What are you talking about? Tip of the spear. We are the tip of the spear. We are the 1 or 2 or 3% of the hobby that do things at a high level. And I'm not talking about building world-class models. I'm talking, we're the guys who fill seams. We're the guys who airbrush.
Whoa, don't put Santucci in this group. He's not in this 1%, is he?
He hasn't. Well, he actually, on the last episode, he talks about how he uses a brush. He doesn't even airbrush yet.
Oh, rattle can.
May I continue before this?
Yes. Yeah, we're going to be ending soon. But yes.
But we are the tip of the spear. And I don't mean that to come across as being elitist. But if you were to put scale modelers into a pyramid shape, we're the tip of the pyramid. And we're the guys who are literally filling seams, painting with an airbrush, using vinyl masks, decal set, you know, Tamiya thin cement. And there are hundreds and hundreds of modelers, thousands and thousands of modelers who are still in the dark ages in their basement using testers tube cement and not painting the models, not, you know, not putting, not putting paint down.
Who's not painting the models? What was that?
And putting them on the shelf and moving on to the next one.
Yep.
And for whatever reason,
possible.
Yeah, and for whatever reason, they don't even know that we exist. Yeah.
Right. I always say that.
Do they want to be like us? Do they want to be the guy that builds that model that ends up on the cover of a magazine? When I was a little kid and I was slapping shit together and then going out and blowing it up with firecrackers? Yeah. I wanted to be the guy that had a model on the cover of Scale Model Aircraft or Fine Scale Modeler back in the day. So we, as the tip of the spear, as the top of the pyramid, whatever analogy that you want to use, we need to be reaching out to those people that are still stuck in the basement who don't know that we exist.
Absolutely. Open the eyes.
We need to be promoting this hobby. We need to be unplugging them with the Matrix reference.
Yep.
And we need to be bringing them into the fold, and we need to be educating them, and we need to be motivating them and inspiring them.
Shit, this dude really fires you up.
Right. Deep thoughts from Jeff Hearn right now.
AMPS Nationals coming up in South Bend are going to be a blast.
Oh, we're going to have a great time with that.
AMPS members, you know, and put it aside, take some vacation time, take a personal day, go. Come and hang out with us, raise hell, have fun. We laugh nonstop, usually because they're laughing at Riv, but, you know, we have a good time.
It's going to be a good time. It is going to be a good time, and I look forward to that.
Yep.
All right. So we're going to sign off, and we want to thank Jeff for coming on again. I know, Toots, you want any parting words for Mr. Hearn?
Well, I appreciate your candor and your time, because I know your time is precious with all you have going on. So on behalf of the podcast, thank you. A
couple hours with your friends.
Yeah, happy to be there. And again, this is not work. I enjoy doing this stuff.
Yeah.
And Justin, anything to say to Mr. Hearn?
Well, Jeff, it was great to officially meet you. Going back to your statement of how you like to see customers using your products and whatnot, since I do plan on being at NATS, AMPS NATS, mm-hmm. I'm going to have to get my KV going because I got those KV tracks from you. I'm going to have to get that KV2 from Tamiya going so that I can show off your tracks.
KV2, so you got the 700 millimeter early style?
I think so. I'll double check. But I also have a Ryfield KV1. So.
Okay, so that would probably use the 650 millimeter Okay. And then I have two varieties available, one with all guide teeth and then one with the spacer link and the little bump. So figure out what you need to let me
know. I don't know anything about any of it. So
I didn't either until Neil Stokes told me all about it.
Gotcha.
I sent an email to Neil and I'm like, okay, dude, you got to educate me on KV1 tracks. And I said, you know, you really got to like write it out in crayon because I'm not that bright. He thought that was hilarious, but sure enough, damn it all, didn't he, you know? He perfect. That's what I need. And then I literally would send him pictures of track links and I'd say, okay, what can I use this on? Here's the track I built. What tank can I put this on? And he'd send me the list. And that's what ended up on the cover of the package.
So, yeah, anybody knows that is Neil.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
Well, again, Jeff, I'm glad you came on and we got to do this again. I know you're going to be doing your rounds on the other podcasts.
Yep.
So I look forward to hearing how you are over there. It's not going to be as risque as this one.
No, I have to wear different hats for different
right. podcasts. You're not going to be dropping F-bombs over there on the posse.
So I don't think I did too many here, did I?
No, I don't think so.
I mean, I dropped a couple F-bombs, but that's always going to happen. We were pretty good. But we're going to sign off now. Again, like I said, Rob Adams is not here. He had to leave, but we will sign off. So again, we appreciate everybody listening to the podcast. Again, you can find us on Apple, Spotify, Google Podcasts, which is soon to be YouTube Podcasts, as well as Amazon and other podcast hosting companies, as well as the RSS Buzzsprout feed.
And modelpodcasts.com. You can find all the podcasts over there.
Thank you, Justin. There you can find everybody. So again, we're going to sign off. And for the Model Insanity Podcast, I'm Rob Riv. I'm with my co-host, Mr. Justin Ryan.
T's and P's, ladies and gentlemen. T's and P's.
Mr. Steve Santucci.
Until next time.
Sans Rob Adams, who had a jet. So see you later, Rob. Our special guest, Mr. Jeff Hearn.
Thanks for having me, guys. It's been fun.
All right, guys. Thanks a lot. A lot of shit going on in the background over there. You're doing pretty good, Jeff.
No, I'm not. But
what happened now?
Just fucking too much work and not enough me.
Listen, you're a 3D printing maestro now. There should be no reason why you haven't made a second Jeff Hearn. I mean, you need a really big fucking machine to make that, but
no, you build do them in parts, then assemble them.
Still need a big one, especially for the midsection. I'm joking, Jeff.
It depends on how you define the midsection.
Do you have the Wolfman Jack voice ready to go?
All right, babies. It's 24 minutes past the hour, 5 o'clock, and you're listening to Rob Riviezzo. My prostate is in my throat. That's why I talk the way I do.
Okay, then.
I mean, everybody knows Jeff. You know, Jeff is he's a known guy. You know, he's a made guy. So when you're a made guy like Jeff Hearn, a lot of people know you.
Right? Good, bad, or ugly, right?
Well, mostly ugly. But
mostly
it's okay.
Ugly, yeah. I'm not going to argue with you at that point.
Listen, about time that someone else is on the screen that's not as ugly as Justin that I get to look at. Oh, shit. Sorry, Justin.
Before we get started, let me get the French fries out of my beard, Rob.
Hold on, just take a quick pause so I got a break.
Oh, he's got a fart.
No, I want to pause so I know where to edit, asshole. This is what I mean. You see what I got to deal with, Jeff? You were right about everything, man. You know what?
I know.
You get that realization and you say to yourself, you know when you're like, it's like a parent moment where you're like, that guy doesn't know shit. And then when you get old, you're like, holy shit, man. My old man was right about everything. Mm-hmm. And there's sometimes when I'm doing, and there's times when I'm doing this podcast where I'm like, holy cow, now I know why Jeff would be so mad and miserable all the time. I see why.
Hey, Jeff, man, unless you've done it, you don't know, right?
True.
Right.
Jeff, I made a point when he started this that I wanted to be one-tenth the menace he was to you as I could be to him.
Thank you.
I was good to Hefe. Don't say that. I gotta say something really quick, and Tooch is not what I'm gonna say. Adams, you're fucking stoned right now. I could tell.
Oh yeah.
I just, we were, dude, you are, we got to speak, you're supposed to be on your best behavior. We got a guest here tonight.
But dude, hold it's on. Medicinal. It's medicinal. So, you know.
What?
Hold on. The beginning of the last episode, which hasn't been released yet, you're like, I like you when you're stoned and disheveled.
Oh, well, and stoned, then, I mean, disheveled is a, it goes without saying.
No, no, stoned. It doesn't matter. we're all good.
No, you're doing good, though, tonight. Keep it up. This is why I got you as my color man tonight. Justin hasn't said a word, this poor bastard. He's just been sitting here in La La Land. He's tired.
Well, and that's why, I keep checking on him.
but what eventually
you dirty
happened,
bitch.
Yeah. I've been called worse by bad men.
Bark like a dog for me. Bark like a dog.
But
actual.
Yeah, there you go. Welcome to the Miscreant reboot.
Dude, there's a Caddyshack when the old lady's fucking golfing and Bill Murray's like, bark like a dog for me.
So anyway,
she's a tramp.